East Coast Condominiums Association. We're delighted to see a good crowd here. In fact, we were just wondering a moment ago if we're going to have enough chairs. We'll get more if we need them. If you'd rise, please, for the Pledge of Allegiance. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Be seated. Membership report. We dropped four associations, and there are no new associations this time to report. We dropped five businesses, and we have a number of new businesses. I want to read the names of the new businesses, and if someone here from that business, stand up, and I'll give you a minute to tell people what you do. It's just about a minute. Gall Painting and Home Repair. Hanson Appraisal Services.
I am Bonnie Worthy from Hanson Appraisal Service, and we'd love to take care of your replacement cost estimates.
Well, thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Paver Saver Pros. Space Coast Fire and Safety. World Electronics and Consulting. Professional Construction.
I'm Andrew. I'm the President of Professional Construction Restoration. We do flood fire repairs, hand mold damage, and things like that. We directly bill insurance companies. We use Xactimate as a format for all of the billing. We not only dry out the buildings, we'll also rebuild entire condominium complexes. We have an office here in Brevard County, one in Orlando, one in Tallahassee. For the hurricanes, we end up working throughout the southeastern United States. We have enough drying equipment to dry out
of your handouts on the table back in the back.
Okay.
We have one individual, Joseph Aldastra. Oh, stand up.
Hi.
Welcome, we're glad to have you come.
Thank you, Harry.
Our membership, we have 17 individuals. We have 142 businesses. We have 263 associations with 19,214 units represented there. We're maintaining our numbers. We're doing rather well, as a matter of fact. Next, I'd like to have the Treasurer's Report, Clay Witt.
Good morning, everyone. At first, this might sound like bad news because we are currently for the year through the end of September 37-6205 deficit, but believe it or not, that's actually good news because we had decided, the board of Space Coast had decided to use some of our reserves to modernize our data systems, to make sure of our hairs turn gray because of all the things we've been doing manually, and also to help serve you better. And we've been able to pay for about half of that project out of current income. So actually, we're doing quite well. All our bills are paid and current. We have no long-term liability. and we have current assets of $32,614.19. So we are quite solvent, thanks to you. Your dues payments are what makes it possible for us to do things for you, and we appreciate it. If at any time anyone would like additional information, just email us, and we'll be happy to provide you with any additional financial information you might want. Thank you.
Thank you, Clay. Have a few announcements. Our next program after today is November the 1st. It'll be here at the Holiday Inn. And this is another one of our series on disaster mitigation. That one focuses on the role of the engineer and the role of the general contractor. If you have a major damage to your to the buildings in your association, to your property, there are all sorts of things that you need to do, and you're going to learn about those today. But you can't do those without an engineer and a general contractor, and so we're going to have Bud Cairns as the engineer. You may recall him. He spoke one time a couple of years ago. It was a very popular program. And we're going to have Tim Teasdale from Restore One as a general contractor. One thing I asked them to do is to explain how you can best ensure that when you do have an emergency, these people are going to be available to you, because you know everybody's going to be calling them. I don't know how they solve that problem, so I'm looking forward to that with great interest, too. Presidents Forum, the next Presidents Forum, I believe, is October the 18th, is it not? Where's Beverly? October 18th?
October 18th at the Royal Towers, yeah. 10 o'clock?
Yep, 10 o'clock, October the 18th, Royal Towers.
Can I say something, Aaron? To the ones that are coming, please try and let me know ahead of time. If you remember last President's Forum, I didn't know who ran out of attendance. So when you get your notice from me, just 2 minutes, you can reply to me and let me know you're coming. Okay? Thank you. Thank you, Aaron. Mm-hmm.
Next thing, something that's new for us, we made a video recording of the August 23rd meeting when Pete Dunbar spoke. And we made a DVD of it. Turned out beautifully. In fact, we had an audio recording that was just loaded with background noise, and we had the DVD in which the background noise was almost entirely missing. You don't even notice it. This is an experimental thing. We're doing the same thing again today. But one question to you is whether you would have an interest in buying these DVDs for any of the meetings. Don't yet have a price for them. They don't cost much, and we're not trying to make money on them. But there's a fixed charge, and then there's a charge per DVD. Probably $10 would cover any one of them. But we're going to have to experiment with this. We're not in a position to make 50 or 100 of them and then wait and see if anybody wants them, because we've got to put that money out in front.
Can I order one now?
Not right this minute. But in particular for that August 23rd program, we don't have copies of them available, but we can make a bunch. You know, if 20 or 30 people wanted copies of these things, we could have them made. So think about that. They really worked out well, and we're making one today, too, so hopefully this will be good.
Somebody wanted the Dunbar. How do you get it?
Get in touch with us outside of this meeting, and we'll...
You don't have to sign up either.
Let me go again and
find you. Okay,
leave a sign-in sheet at the back, Harry.
Sure. Okay, because good suggestion. Put a sign-up sheet in the back, and so if you know already that you would like to have that, sign up. But you're not limited to that. If after this meeting you decide you want it. But let us know. Just get in touch with us. We did another interesting thing. The Chamber of Commerce at Ponte Vedra Beach had a luncheon in honor of Bruce Douglas, who's the chairman of the Board of Citizens Insurance, Property Insurance Company. You'll recall, perhaps, that a little over 2 years ago, we had a large insurance meeting in this room. In fact, we had the whole space open. We had 600 chairs. We had 400 people there. We had four speakers. Bruce Douglas, the chairman of the board of citizens, was one of our speakers, and incidentally, Lou Byron was one of them. So we traveled up to this Chamber of Commerce luncheon, and we made a DVD of that. That, too, turned out extremely well. And so we sent copies of this DVD to Bruce Douglas, to the President of Citizens, to the Executive VP of Citizens, to the Chamber of Commerce, to a number of people. And they were delighted with them. The reason we did all this is that we want to make sure that we've got good points of contact with the citizens, and you can't get much better than the President. So I think that we have an entree into that in case we need that at some point. I have learned that once again, Brevard County is taking steps to enforce the turtle lighting rules. They have recently notified Cocoa Beach of people that they think are violating the rules, and Cocoa Beach is writing up the association. Now, if somebody in a unit has the lights on, there's nothing that the association can do to make them cover the lights or turn the lights out. We can tell the people about the rules. We can tell them to not have any visible lights at night. But there's no way that we can force all this. And so what we've got to do is educate Cocoa Beach and any other cities where this occurs, so if they understand that if they're going to write up in about it, it has to be the individual who's violating the rule. It cannot be the association. Now, we went through this about 4 years ago, and the county just ignored the impeccable logic that I just explained to you, that we can't do it. And they're still trying to fine the associations, and I heard of a few cases where associations paid fines of a few hundred dollars. So at any rate, watch for it. Make sure that you very nicely talk to the code enforcement people. Explain that there's nothing you can do other than notify the owners and give them the information about the rules. But you cannot go into their unit and turn the light out for them. I wanted to mention one other thing. Just last day or two, I have found out that I've been told at least that there's one condominium that has in their documents rules saying that no children younger than 12 can occupy the units. And they're trying to enforce it. And in fact, they may have jeopardized the sale by telling the realtor and the potential buyer that they couldn't move in.
Not one of my clients, I hope.
At any rate, I wanted to mention it because I thought that everybody knew by now that you cannot have rules of this nature where you specify the ages of children occupying units. I'm not going to the over 55 at the opposite extreme. But just so you know, you cannot do this. I don't care what your documents say. And if Paul will say anything about it later, I'll leave that to him. Now, our program today is one of our disaster mitigation programs. I asked Paul Wayne and Lou Byron to speak today. If you have a disaster, if you have damage to your property, you have got to do something to make the property whole. And you've got to be familiar with what the requirements are, what you must do and what you can do according to law. And directly related to that is what the insurance requirements are. And so I asked Paul Wien to come today to talk about what you can and must do legally to restore the property, and asked Lou Byron to come and talk about the insurance aspects of it. Now, knowing their backgrounds, they're going to be interchangeable on a lot of this, so don't expect a clear demarcation between those two subjects. In fact, the new insurance law is written by the Advisory Council on Condominiums. Paul Wien was a member of that, and as a service to or a secretary to the organization, I guess I should say, he wrote the current law. That does not mean that he is in favor of all the things in the current law. But he wrote it for the Advisory Council, and it was picked up in a bill and made law. Lou Byron testified before the Advisory Council to answer questions and explain what the impact would be of various things and what his interpretation of what the insurance companies would go along with. And they did check with insurance companies as well. So I mentioned this so that you will know that they are not responsible for it, but they are about as knowledgeable in the background of it as anybody you can find. Now, a little bit about them. Paul Wien used to head up the Orlando office of Becker and Polyakov. This was years ago before he decided to go out on his own. And I think he's much happier in life with running his own company than he was in a big corporation.
No tie.
I was going to add that. I remembered that, Paul. Dress code is a little bit...
a little more lax, yeah.
Right, right. Paul has spoken to Space Coast Condo a number of times. Every time I get involved with legislation, no matter how it is, Paul is there ahead of me. And more importantly, he many times has helped write new legislation. And I would like to add that, in my opinion, he has done a brilliant job on that. I've seen over the last few years a number of people who write proposed legislation. I don't know anybody who does as well as Paul does. Lou Byron is a professional insurance agent and insurance counselor. He's been doing it about 36 years, I think. He went to the University of Florida, graduated there. He's worked for several insurance agencies. Now he's associated with Sealy Insurance Agent, agency over in Altamont Springs. I'm very familiar with this because I drive over there for the FLA meetings, the Florida Legislative Alliance meetings. He's done a number of other things. He was past president of the Mid-Florida chapter of the Community Associations Institute. He was chairman of the CAI Florida Legislative Alliance. In fact, I suspect he occupied all of those steps going up through president. He's past president of the Mount Dora Chamber of Commerce. He's associated with the East Lake Chamber of Commerce. And beyond that, I don't know, Lou, because I have not updated this recently.
And I forget, too. It all blurs after a while.
After 36 years, it blurs. So with that, I would like to turn the meeting over to Paul and Lou. I don't know which one's planning to come first. I'll be just as surprised as you are.
Can you hear me?
you hear me now? Can you hear me now? Can you hear me now? Okay. Good morning, everybody. Thank you for coming out on a Saturday morning. How about those Red Sox? I'm still half asleep from watching them win last night, and I'm very happy about that. Following up on a couple of things that Harry said, first of all, if you wish a DVD of this program, Lou Byron has agreed to make it a twofer, so you get a copy of The Towering Inferno, as well as this program. Another thing, I want to correct a misimpression. I did not draft the new version of 718.111.11. I was one of several co-drafters of that new statute. In fact, Harry sent me a bunch of questions, all very good questions, about 5 pages of questions in anticipation of this program, and I was amused by the last comment, which said, why can't this statute be as nice and clear as Pete Dunbar's book? Well, guess who one of the other drafters of the statute was? Pete Dunbar, that's right. Pete Dunbar, Joe Adams from Becker and Polyakov, my former partner, myself, Mike Andrew, who was the chairman of the advisory council. Those were the attorneys that had input into the statute that is now in effect. It went into effect as of October 1st. And that's a lot of what we're going to be talking about. So, with that in mind, let's start, and I hope you've all got, we had two handouts up there in the back. Did you all get a copy? Okay. Well, you can pick it up on the way out, or if you have to stretch your legs, but we'll discuss the scenarios. We've created two disaster scenarios that we're going to use as a basis for our discussion. We'll go over them with you, but before we do that, I want to start with pre-disaster preparation, because frankly, pre-disaster preparation is really the key. If you have a disaster and then try to approach resolving the problems that you're facing after the disaster, you're already at a losing proposition. So the first thing to do is let's talk about a disaster preparation or disaster preparedness plan. By show of hands, how many of you in your associations have such a plan? Okay. Maybe a little less than half. Are there any of you who have buildings that are at least 75 feet high that don't have such a plan? Let me see hands. You are in violation of law. As of 2006, an amendment was made to Section 550, let's give you exactly here, Section 553.509, Florida statutes, and it requires that every multifamily dwelling, including condominiums, that is at least 75 feet high and that has public elevators, have a plan for alternate energy to power at least one of those elevators. In addition, however, all of those structures are required to have a disaster preparedness plan. To cite the language specifically from the statute, here is what it says that you're required to have in it. A written emergency operations plan that details the sequence of operations before, during, and after a natural or man-made disaster or other emergency situation. The plan must include, at a minimum, a life safety plan for evacuation, maintenance of the electrical and lighting supply, and provisions for the health, safety, and welfare of the residents. Now, if you don't have that and you're at least 75 feet high, you are in violation of the law, and you need to do that right away. But my first message to all of you is that this, while not mandatory, is a damn good idea for you to prepare. Now, I have an emergency disaster preparedness plan that was provided to me by a manager that I work with. I was extremely impressed with the thoroughness of this plan, and while I can't give it to you because it's not my work product, I would like to go over some of the elements that ought to be in your plan. A lot of people create plans. Newspapers publish them. Those are good things to have. But it really helps to have something that's extremely local and that addresses the unique issues of the residents in your community. The first consideration she has in here is whether or not you should evacuate. What are the criteria? Are you in a flood zone? If so, are you in a storm surge zone? If so, you should evacuate. She, of course, discusses the availability of shelters, and she did a survey of the shelters that are available in the immediate area of this particular building. She also did a survey of structures or shelters that will take animals, because pets are a real serious concern. We don't like to see abandoned pets. So those are two considerations that she's put in here. She has discussed the evacuation routes from the building in question, how the best evacuation routes are and where facilities are along the way. She also addressed contact information. Now, this is something that the association also ought to have as part of its emergency preparedness plan. It ought to have a list of emergency contacts for every owner that is a member of the association, both locally and outside the area, so that if you need decisions made or you need to give information, it's just a phone call away, assuming you have phone power restored. Bridges. She discusses specifically the bridges surrounding the property and what is likely to occur with those bridges in the event of an impact. She then goes on to discuss what should be in a disaster supply case and how to create and maintain a safe room in a structure and rules about that. So she's got a list of supplies that are needed. She's got a list of other food essentials, water essentials. She discusses how to clean water, to make your own drinking water. And then, as I said, she goes into things like avoiding excess heat and that type of thing. She also gives a thorough list of local authorities and their phone numbers. She gives a list of radio stations or other places where information may be had. She discusses things like, you know, weather radios and those hand crank ones that can be used for a fairly extended period of time, even when there's no electrical power. This is the kind of thing that you need to get to your members, and she also addresses people with special needs. So these are the kinds of issues that you need to address, and I really recommend that you prepare this, because it will help focus the board and help organize the owners. And I think something like this is crucial. So the first step here is to focus on the question of what you do in terms of emergencies. You also ought to focus on the question of returning home. When is it safe to return home? How can people who have been evacuated contact you? And that sort of thing. Now, as part and parcel of this preparedness plan, the legislature itself also has addressed the question of disasters, and it has created a new statute that went into effect this year. It was actually written by Joe Adams, who also was a co-contributor to the insurance rewrite. It was on the shelf for several years, and it found its way into House Bill 995 and finally became law this year as of October 1st. The new section is called Section 718.1265 Florida Statutes, and it's a very good piece of work. What it does is it says that once we have a declared disaster, we have a proclamation, and there's a specific statute that indicates when something is a declared disaster. And if that disaster declaration touches the locale where the property is located, suddenly we dispense with a lot of the consumer protections that people are used to in a condominium. The board can, for example, giving the best practical notice, hold meetings. Regardless of what is in the documents, it can levy assessments. It can also take steps to mitigate damage, and that means going into your unit, throwing out your furniture that might be soaked, or pulling up your rugs and getting rid of it. It takes action for the benefit, health, safety, and welfare of the members. There are certain things, of course, that you as an owner are obligated to do, but if you can't get back to your premises, then it's very hard for you to do it. And what this statute contemplates is that if the association does things that is the responsibility of the owner, and the owner then comes back, the owner has to reimburse the association for those expenses, and they are lienable in the event the owner declines to do so. So there are a lot of emergency powers here. The board has the ability to appoint substitute officers, including people who have no relationship to the condominium, if the officers that have been elected or appointed are no longer available. calls upon specifically the board to implement a disaster plan immediately upon the event occurring. So this kind of statute seems to be mandating the type of disaster plan that was previously talked about that came into effect for buildings that are 75 feet or over. It now seems to say that the board needs to implement a plan in all condominiums. So I urge you to do so. It also gives this emergency powers provision also gives the association the authority to rely on advice. Now, I've talked to many of you before about the exercise of business judgment by boards in community associations. And I've told you that there are a certain stable of experts that a board relies on. As a fiduciary, you don't get to make decisions by the seat of your pants. Your job as a fiduciary is to use the best available information to make your judgments. And so if you think that it's okay, we're going to ride out this storm and then a big wave comes and knocks the building down, you may have a breach of fiduciary duty claim against you, among many other claims. However, if you go to an expert who says this building will withstand a Category 5 storm no problem, you are justified in relying on the advice of those experts. So what this says to me is you have to go out and you have to, as part of your disaster preparedness plan, now more than ever, find yourself a technical expert, be it an engineer or an architect or a building inspector or someone of that nature, and have them available. You have to know how to contact them, and you are entitled to rely on their advice when it comes to taking steps to mitigate damages or to make repairs. So if your expert says you've got to go into this unit and rip out the carpets and throw away all the furniture, you are entitled to rely on that expert's advice. And you will have no liability if you do. You also are entitled, if you cannot find an expert, to rely on the advice of emergency management officials. However, I don't want to recommend that you do that because of the doctrine called sovereign immunity. Sovereign immunity is from old England. It means the king was infallible. And our king is called government. And when a building official gives advice in his capacity as a government official, he's immune from liability. So if he tells you no problem, just leave it, and it molds the building up and you have to now demold the whole building, you don't have any cause of action against that building official. On the other hand, your private expert, you would have cause of action against, presuming they, of course, have liability insurance, which is always an issue with engineers. They usually have a very severe cap on their liability. But that's another issue. So you have the ability to make actions under this scenario when there is a declared emergency and when you have expert advice. So part of your disaster preparation, in addition to preparing a plan, is to have people that you can call, who you pay for advice on technical issues, who may be able to get to your area and examine the problems and give you advice on how to mitigate further damage and how to make emergency repairs. One other thing that is in here that you may be willing to know about, want to know about, based on what happened in our experiences in 2004, if there is an evacuation order, people are, of course, supposed to evacuate, but very rarely do they come and drag you out by the heels. If the association determines, after consulting with an expert, that portions of the property or the property as a whole is uninhabitable, then you notify the owners to vacate. If they then do not vacate, then the word used in the statute is immune. The association is immune from suit. Now, there are a group of people in my profession called trial lawyers who, when they look at legislation, they look for words like immunity, and they don't let those words go through legislation unchallenged. But in this case, it was unchallenged, and it did get passed with the word immunity. Immunity means just that. If someone gets hurt after being told to evacuate and they try to sue you, there's going to be no claim. So they do so at their own risk, and you have the ability to order them out with the advice of an expert. Again, not based on a seat of a pants analysis, but with the advice of expert or emergency management officials. Tell them that we believe this place is unsafe, it's not habitable, get out. Once you've put that in writing to them and they're aware of it, if they stay, they do so solely at their own risk. So, to summarize what I've said so far, you need to think about this. You need to put together a comprehensive disaster plan in advance and line up your experts, the people who you can consult with in advance. You need to know how to contact your owners or people who represent your owners in the event of an emergency. And it goes without saying, you need to have people on the board who will be in communication with each other. So you need to know how to contact the other board members as well. Now, there's another area of pre-disaster preparation that I encourage you to consider, and that is the financial aspects of the disaster. Have any of you read the new version of 718-111-11? Yeah?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. You seem to have a familiarity with it. Let's compare and contrast for a moment the earlier version and what went into effect on October 1st in at least one regard. It used to be that you had to have adequate insurance, and adequate insurance was defined as replacement cost. Okay? What it now says is you have to have adequate insurance defined as replacement cost based on a periodic appraisal. But, am I going in and out here?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm sorry? Okay.
Well, I can yell. Can you hear me?
No, you're good. You're good.
All right. I'll continue to fade in and out. Okay. The statute now says that when you have an appraisal and when you do your estimate of replacement cost, you can modify that. And you can modify this in one of several ways. The statute speaks first off of what is customary in terms of coverage and deductibles in the area and in the industry that we're talking about. So what kind of policies are being offered in your area? And you can go with that type of a typical policy, even though it may have higher deductibles and therefore leave you with a gap in coverage. In addition, the board also has the ability to consider its cash on hand, including reserves. And so it can factor in that cash on hand and its reserves and therefore set a lower policy limit perhaps, but probably more likely a higher deductible. So when you have a high deductible, your cost of insurance goes down. The idea here is to give you some ability to balance the cost of the insurance versus what assets you have. The new and more intriguing and third way, and these are not mutually exclusive, that you can address this issue is by holding a meeting of the board, duly noticed, with proper notice, and adopting what amounts to a conditional special assessment. That is a special assessment that will be placed on the owners in the event of a declared disaster or in the event of substantial damage to the property. And so if you levy, for example, a $5,000 per unit special assessment, that is an obligation on then current owner that will kick into play immediately upon a declaration of disaster or a substantial loss or however the board wishes to word the resolution. And that additional cash, that promise of cash, can be used as a factor when you determine what your deductibles ought to be. Okay? Now, there's one other one that isn't discussed in the statute. Lou and I had talked about this many years ago when we had first discussed rewriting the then current statute. And this is something that I think both of us recommend, and that is a standby line of credit. And I really urge you to do that. In fact, I said to Lou, if we had been smart, we would have had a banker here with cards, and we would have been taking a piece of the commission on each one. Because it really doesn't cost that much. I think Lou advised me that it's, what, 0.5%? So if you got a $500,000 line of credit, 0.5% would be, what, about $2,500 a year to maintain a line of credit that would pay you $500,000 when you ask for it. Of course, you'll have to pay interest once you draw that money, but it's money that you have effectively reserved and can hold on to and have available to you, assuming that the bank is in a position to do business with you. So, and in fact, in our scenario, I think we had a scenario where we, in the second scenario, we have this where people have a line of credit from Bear Stearns. And that may be unfortunate for that association. But the point is, it's a good idea, I think, to have a line of credit in addition to having reserves, in addition to having the standby special assessment. One point that I want to make, without going through it in too much detail now, if you read the statute on insurance, you'll note that there is specific language that mandates, very clearly mandates, that all owners have unit owner policies, and that all of those policies include loss assessment coverage in an amount of not less than $2,000. Now, that means that when you do this standby special assessment, if you do a $5,000 special assessment, the first $2,000 of that's going to be picked up by the owner's insurance. So you effectively have $2,000 per owner sitting there waiting for you, and you can factor that in when you figure out how much your owners can afford to pay. So maybe it's not $5,000, maybe it's $7,000. Okay? And when you have that money available, I mean, you're going to have to figure some people are going to disappear, some people aren't going to be available to pay you, some people aren't going to have $5,000 cash on hand. So you've got to really figure out about what you really realistically think you can collect of that special assessment when you factor in what kind of deductibles you should have. So that's my little discussion on the question of pre-disaster preparedness financial planning. And then finally, we started to discuss this unit owner policy issue. And this is language that I think we received a question on, and it was language that I had some say in writing. The prior statute was unclear. It could be read two ways as to whether or not an owner was mandated to have a policy. The intent of the prior statute was to require owners to have their own policies. However, what it said was the owner's policy shall do this and shall do that, but it didn't say specifically the owner had to have this policy. So it was very unclear. This statute says each owner must have both property damage and liability coverage. Now, property damage is what Lou would term first-party insurance. That means it covers their own loss. Liability is what we term third-party coverage. The person who is protected is a third party who is injured. And so when you have the water leak down into the next unit, in theory, that unit owner's liability coverage should pay the claim if we can prove some sort of negligence on the part of the owner who is the insured. So, what you want to do, the statute says you can, at least once a year, require that the owner produce proof of insurance. Now, I recommend that you consider doing this in conjunction with the calling of your annual meeting. And that means that you ask the owner to submit, when they return their proxy, a copy of their certificate of insurance. And if they do not do so, you have rights essentially that are similar to those of a first mortgagee. You as the association can go out and purchase a policy on the unit, and the cost of that policy is an assessment for which you may lien and foreclose if you are not reimbursed by the owner. So I strongly recommend that you figure out how you're going to ask for verification of the insurance and when you're going to do it, and then implement that as part of a policy, probably in connection with your communications over the annual meeting. Are there any questions? What we're going to do is we're going to take questions related to the topic. If you're off point, we'll tell you, we'll ask, answer that later. But is there any questions based on what I've said so far?
I think the statute says if the owner doesn't get the insurance, that the board of directors shall or may.
Yes.
And the second part of the question is, it doesn't say that they can or that they will get the coverage for them. The second part of that question is, I've been told that it may not be possible for the association to insure property for a third person.
Yeah, I think that's a real issue because you don't have any idea what kind of... did you all hear that?
No.
Okay. Well, let's start by repeating the question. With regard to purchasing an owner's policy on behalf of an owner, the question is it a shall, is it a mandatory, or is it a may? And I believe the answer is the statute says it's a may. However, I would respectfully suggest that when we go back to the point that the board has a fiduciary duty, that not buying the policy could create liability on the part of the board, and that would be a problem. The concept that I had when we started to rewrite this was that we wanted to be able to restore the building to a habitable shell, and that's part of the reason why we shifted responsibility for insurance on air conditioning, because if the owner didn't have air conditioning, how would you restore that system that treats the particular unit, you may wind up with an uninhabitable unit or units in the middle of your high-rise. So that's one of the reasons we changed that. But although the statute says may, I think the idea of the may was that you only would do this if you can't control the owner into doing it themselves. But I think that the idea here is, as a fiduciary, you will want to do this if the owner simply refuses entreaties to have the policy. The other point that the gentleman made was whether or not it was possible to obtain coverage on somebody else's property. Now, that goes to the question of whether there's an insurable interest. I'll let Lou address that, but I would suggest that the statute grants effectively an insurable interest and that you have an ability to acquire that. You're not so much interested in how much their property is insured for, only that you have some insurance that covers liability to the association and that covers the essential systems in the property. Since you're having an appraisal every 3 years in terms of replacement value, I respectfully suggest that will give you as good an indication when you do apply your percentage ownership of the amount of coverage you should be having if you're in buying an involuntary policy. Okay? Yes, sir.
I understand the logic of the loss assessment requirement. On the other hand, in 2004, it was really unevenly applied by the insurance company. The people who had loss assessments, some of them got reimbursed for a special assessment and others did not. There were some insurance companies who were actually asking the high buyers what the special assessment covers. Does the legislation provide uniform coverage, or is it still up to, you know, consumer beware and having to really drill down with the insurer to find out what they mean by loss assessment?
The answer is yes. Consumer beware. It is. There is nothing in the legislation that says that the underwriting criteria for determining whether to pay on this is this, this, and this. That will ultimately be an individual insurance company's underwriting decision.
On the special assessment that's related to the insurance policy, will insurance companies put that in?
I couldn't hear the first part of that. Will they?
Loss assessment that you can write into the insurance.
Well, that's what loss assessment coverage is.
And they will take
they are required by this statute to include that in any policy they write for owners after January 1, 2009. One of the other questions we got, by the way, was what happens with your current policy? The answer is your current policy stays as it is. These requirements are phased in as of January 1st. And so on the anniversary date of your policy as an association, that is when the new policy would kick in.
My second question was, I believe in the bill it says something about making the loss pay the association.
It says that the association is an additional insured on the unit owner policies.
Now, why would they do that?
So that you can insure somebody else's property. And so that you can take the money that's available and use it to do reconstruction, because the statute also says that the association is responsible for overseeing or actually performing all reconstruction work. So you would want to have the ability to collect that, those funds from your unit owners, insurers, and then use that money to rebuild the property. Okay? Ma'am, one more and then I'll turn this over to Lou. Well, if with regard to foreclosures, if there is a foreclosure pending and you haven't gotten proof of insurance, I would strongly recommend the association obtain that policy. Once the foreclosure has been completed and there is a bank as the owner, then you would demand that the bank produce proof of insurance and then cancel the balance of your policy. Okay? Let me turn it over to Lou.
Thank you, Paul. Yes, Harry.
May I say two things, please? One, I failed to say earlier that preferably, if you could write your questions down, it would help. There are cards on the table back there, and we will see to it that the two speakers get those questions. And the other thing is that Surf Pro South in West Melbourne, Brevard County, I guess it is, first saw the refreshments, and I failed to give them credit for that. They went all out. And we do appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, Harry. Thank you, Paul. And I will address a couple of points in Paul's ending comments as it applies, I believe, in the real world of insurance versus the philosophies adopted by our legislature under the new laws. And those deal specifically with this lady's question earlier about the question of adding the association on as an additional insured. Actually, the statute says an additional named insured, which is different yet from an additional insured. An additional named insured basically says that the policy would be written in John Jones and XYZ Condominium Association, which also means that any check paid under that policy would be to both the condominium and the individual. Whereas an additional insured is merely an endorsement that recognizes the interest of the condominium in the property insured without also being part of the first line of the policy in the name. It is very, very doubtful that we will have any insurance company that will comply with the letter of the law. They will not add an additional named insured in the way the statute has been written. In terms of the question of special assessment coverage versus loss assessments coverage, I agree that special assessment and loss assessment are intended to be one and the same. However, it's not really stated that way from the standpoint of insurance. Insurance will be a loss assessment clause, but the statute says special assessment. Likely it's going to be defined the same, but it does leave some room for discussion. And the question of loss and special assessments, some of which we'll talk about as we evolve our disaster scenarios, deals with the matter of insured losses and insured losses only relative to what is covered under the unit owner's policy. So if you have a unit owner's policy that has been purchased ex wind, there's no wind coverage on that unit owner's policy. And you know here you can buy that coverage with or without wind included. If a special assessment is then levied due to wind damage, then that unit owner's policy is not going to respond because it did not include wind. There are some inherent flaws in the way this will work that can create some problems once the reality hits that a lot of what they're trying to accomplish is good, but a lot of what the insurance industry is going to do will conflict. Further, the matter of deductibles. In the last go-round in 2004, probably half of the insurance companies did not pay special assessments when the reason for the special assessment was as a result of a deductible. They considered a deductible as an uninsured issue, as if you didn't have insurance. So it was, again, an uninsured circumstance that caused the assessment. And they said, well, that's not what we intended. We didn't intend to cover uninsured losses. We intended to pay assessments on insured losses. Again, going back to my comments of wind or no wind. Deductible, $500,000, no coverage, no assessment paid. Others defined it differently. So be sure what you're buying. Talk with your professional agent. Understand what's in the policy and where its limitations are and how that particular company is going to define loss assessment versus special assessment. Now, we've defined a couple of hypothetical disaster scenarios that we're going to then work into how the insurance plays, the statute plays, and other good, prudent management of claims plays into these problems that could, in fact, be problems that you could have right here in the next go-round should the worst occur. Scenario number one, for those of you following and have a copy of the handout. We have Hurricane Clarice, a Category 3 storm, that strikes Fort Lauderdale from the southeast. It tracks northerly, meandering up the east coast of Florida. As it contacts land and cooler water, it loses energy. By the time it reaches the space coast, it is only a tropical storm. However, it strikes a 5-story high-rise condominium called a shoddy condominium, built by Third Eye Construction. Though built in 2002, shoddy's work only meets the 1995 building code, thanks to a payoff to the local government inspector. The condominium has 50 units with a replacement value of $9 million. The association passed, did not obtain the optional law and ordinance policy coverage. The damages. Rooftop air conditioning units were blown off and gaping holes were created in the roof, allowing substantial water damage throughout the entire building. The south side of the building had additional damage from shattered windows and sliding glass doors where there were no hurricane shutters or where the shutters were not lowered or where they were dropped but failed, and further water intrusion and wind damage resulted. The condominium documents for shoddy provide that the association shall operate the hurricane shutters. Liability. Although a state of emergency has been declared, some owners have not left their units. The association has taken the following actions prior to the disaster. They've obtained a windstorm policy with a 5% deductible, $450,000. They've adopted a pre-authorized special assessment to cover uninsured losses and deductibles in the amount of $500,000. Obtained a standby line of credit from Bear Stearns in the amount of $500,000 for a 0.5% fee, $2,500 a year to maintain it as open. They have $200,000 in all existing reserve accounts and $100,000 in cash on hand. A lot of issues impacting our first scenario. We'll deal first with the matter of claims process. What are you going to do when the worst occurs? Who do you call? How do you manage the insurance aspect of your problem after the implementation of your disaster preparedness? Certainly, you call your agent. He is the first line of the defense, the first one involved, who helps direct the process from his or her desk. The agent then is responsible to prepare a claim report and file it with the insurance company. And we are assuming that you've not called the 800 number for Citizens and filed the claim direct. If you have done this, you still want to keep your agent involved and understanding what's going on, so he's in a position of running interference when things slow down, as no doubt they will. The agent then, when he files the claim report with the insurance company, they will set up a file and assign an adjuster to the claim, and they will be sent out to assess and adjust your loss. In the meantime, your responsibilities under your policy are to first take steps to prevent your property from sustaining further damage. If that means tarps, boarding up, cutting off water, cutting off electricity, things that are necessary to avoid fires, further water damage, and other problems associated with vandalism, looting, or water continuing to pour in the roof, it is expected that you will do these things initially at your expense, since the insurance company has not yet had an opportunity to determine coverage at all, and if so, adjust for how much they're going to pay. Understanding that those immediate expenses would of course be included as part of your claim and reimbursed. But these requirements to take initial steps to prevent your property from sustaining further damage is a requirement under your policy. Failing to do so, and they determine that further damages ensued due to your failures, they will exclude those additional damages from the total of your claim. The adjuster will then be sent out to work with any contractors that you may have called in to assist in immediate repairs and to determine the value of your total claim against the policy. Once they establish a value for the claim, their responsibility then is to issue the check and pay for the claim. They do not recommend those that would do the repairs, they do not follow up on the adequacy of the repair or deal with any aspect of post-repair warranties or services. They leave that to you. You must choose the contractor, you must arrange for the repairs, and you must pay for it with the check the insurance company gives you, less your deductible. So as you deal with this process of managing the claim, it is clearly very important that your first step out of the box is to get someone out there to assist to make sure that property is locked down and as safe from the standpoint of additional damage as you can possibly make it, and then begin to try to get some people in there to effect repairs. Many times your agent can assist with this. Many times the insurance companies even have lists of preferred vendors, but they will not put their name on a recommendation. They don't want to get held with liability. Well, the insurance company told me to get this guy, and he was shoddy. We're suing the insurance company for giving us an inadequate contractor. That's not an additional liability they are willing to accept. So they're not going to tell you who to use. That will be your choice. The claims process then will take place over a period of time, working with the contractors, and when the initial estimate is made on damage, that may or may not take into account everything that has occurred. Additional damage is discovered after the initial assessment that were not a part of added damage from your failures to lock down the property are called supplemental claims reports. And a supplemental claim report is merely the contractor filing with the company or through the agent. Additional damage is discovered. They will review them, approve them within the scope of coverage, and add them to your claim. And these can often come quite a bit after the initial intended settlement. So you don't necessarily have to fear that the one check you get is all you're ever going to get, because clearly additional problems can arise once they get deeper into the surface of the problem. That's essentially your claims process through to the point where the check is cut and the supplemental process may then take place. Any questions on that? The observations or issues? Yes, ma'am. No, there's no additional deductible for the supplemental. They will presume that the check that had been cut initially is exclusive of the deductible. Therefore, anything else that would be supplemental to that and agreed to by the company would be purely on top of the initial check in its full value without additional deductible applicable. Yes, sir.
And I may be getting ahead, and if so, just say, but we now have under the new statute not only the associations insured involved, but we have all of these insurance companies for the owners, in theory at least, for the association named as an additional insured. Must the association also balance and juggle all these additional claims against all these other policies, how is that going to be?
While yes, that will be part of additional discussion, I will throw that in with regard to where you're at and say it is not the association's responsibility to work with the insurance company of the unit owner, regardless of whether they got added as an additional insured or an additional named insured. It is the owner's responsibility to work with their own company to make sure the claim is filed in the same way with their agent for their inside policy. And then in every case, the insurance company of the association will coordinate with the insurance company of the unit owner to manage the responsibilities inside and make sure each side is taken care of consistent with the statute and the policy of insurance that was acquired. Okay. Yes, sir.
What is the legal time limit on supplemental?
I honestly don't know the legal time frame. I do know that the concept is usually a matter of reasonable expectation within the scope of the repairs. And from that angle, certainly something that pops up 5 years down the road, they're going to, well, where'd that come from? On the other hand, if you are still in the process of repairs and something is discovered a year down the road, that is still going to be within the scope of consideration. If it's done and signed off on, that's certainly the point where the matter of additional supplemental is very, very unlikely. But if repairs are still continuing and something new is discovered, that is within the scope of consideration, and you can always send it in. The worst that's going to happen is the company will say, no, we don't see that as part of the original claim. We believe that is something new. And then it's a matter of negotiation or litigation, as the case may be. But I'm unaware of a particular time. There may be, but I haven't retained it. Yes, sir. It is 5 years? Okay, well, I hit it. 5 years. probably something buried in there. Yes, sir. Well, we would presume in that case, actually the assessment is over and above your property insurance. So the assessment should be full value, should be. But the presumption would be that you've had some other damage inside that's going to eat up your deductible. A lot of that, though, depends on the particular insurance company and how their policy words. And my expectation would be that the loss assessment's benefit will be exclusive of deductible. But different companies can interpret their policy and the way they're going to assign deductibles in different manners. But I believe that I would be accurate in my comment. Now, let's move on. We don't want to get bogged down too much. We've got a lot to cover. Yes?
I have a question. I didn't hear anything mentioned regarding code upgrades on buildings.
We will get to that.
Okay, we're
going
to get to that.
Yep.
Is it still standard 25% of the covered policy is the limit for code upgrades?
Inside, yes. From the standpoint of the master policy, that is a called shot. Their limit is a factor of the need that is assessed by the agent and the insured working with the company as opposed to a specific percentage. But the individual home policies and the unit owner policies have percentage amounts that are included.
And then one more thing. They have another another part of the code where they have a 90 day
Right. And that's still right. They're trying to force them to be more speedy, yet we have a new statute and a new law and an untested circumstance on how well that's going to work and how the insurance companies are going to weasel their way out of it and try to fight it. And then goes the question of, well, paying the claim, if they give you a earnest money deposit, does that extend the 90 days further, or does it all have to be paid? There's still some unanswered questions on exactly how they're going to tackle it, and they can still extend things out for years just playing the game, and that, you know, insurance companies are famous for. Okay, deductibles. We've kind of hit on the deductible issue. I wouldn't plan to take a whole lot of time on this, although I will bring up one point relative to the new statute. As things exist today without modification, your policy's relative deductibles are fashioned in regard to the Plaza East case, which essentially says that if there is a deductible applicable to a single, or excuse me, if there is damage applicable to a single unit, the association cannot make that unit owner responsible for their deductible when it's confined to just that one unit relative to damage. Unit owner has a fire in his unit, and it's the only one damaged, and the entire damage is under the association deductible. They can't pin that deductible on the unit owner, him or herself. It still has to come out of common funds when it's dealing with common property. The new law, however, allows an opt-out feature with regard to Plaza East to give the association the right to modify how deductibles are managed and, in fact, amend their documents to say that if the damage is confined to one unit or one or two units, then the association's deductible can be passed on to the affected unit owners as opposed to being absorbed by the whole. You do have that opt-out provision now properly managed in a change of the documents to effectively eliminate the Plaza East approach to dealing with deductibles that exist today. In this case, dealing with this particular disaster scenario, we have $500,000 virtually of deductibles applicable, $450,000, and we have at least that much in available funds that is coming in for use to pay for that. This deductible, this association appears to be then fairly well taken care of with regard to this first storm, notwithstanding the fact that we've got a possibility of a second storm, and then the question of which deductible applies. It's a tropical storm when it hits you. Shouldn't your lower $5,000 deductible apply since it wasn't a hurricane? Nope. If it was ever a hurricane, the hurricane deductible applies. Ever a hurricane that was threatening coastal Florida. And a hurricane flag went up for coastal Florida. So you get a hurricane out in the Gulf that becomes a tropical storm, and no part of Florida ever has the hurricane warning flag waved, and it remains a tropical storm, a la Fay, you will have the lower deductible. If, as in our scenario here, it became a hurricane that impacted any area of the state, and hurricane warnings went up, and then dropped to tropical storm status, then you will have your full percentage hurricane deductible applicable. Coverage limitations. In dealing with your insurance policies, there are several areas where you could have coverage limitations applicable. First, of course, is do you have enough insurance? Is the $9 million enough in this particular example? Sadly, when you deal with insurance, you don't know until you get there, because one of the responsibilities of the insurance companies is to assess, appraise the value of the insured property at the time of loss in order to determine the adequacy of the insurance that was in place. Arguably then, because it came from someone who's trying to save money, is the adequacy of that appraisal that the insurance company does at the time of the loss. But presuming that it is accurate, and it's proven to be so, then that would stand as the basis upon which they would determine how much they're going to pay with regard to, and we'll get to this later, coinsurance penalties and other factors. So one limitation of your policy certainly could be the question of value in regard to the $9 million in this particular community. Another is a matter of replacement cost versus actual cash value. We know what the statute says. But what did you get sold, or what did your board buy without proper knowledge of the contract of insurance they acquired? There are two types of insurance policies for property. One is replacement cost, like kind and quality of materials and workmanship at today's prices. And then there's actual cash value. Same definition, less depreciation for the age of the property. And it's surprising, the older the property, the more the insurance company will try to get away with an actual cash value product. So the more you need it, the more you got to watch yourself in what you're being given. Because it is quite frequent that you could have a company, maybe other than Citizens, that would write you an actual cash value policy, and you might not know it until the worst occurs. Watch what you're buying. Actual cash value on a property that was built in 1950, you might get a 40, 50% depreciation against your claim. This property is newer. You don't have that issue, presumably, with regard to the question of actual cash value. Because it's newer property, the depreciation is not as much, but it's still in violation of statute and not by any means your best form of coverage. Mold. Mold is typically a standard exclusion in all of your property policies for the master. There may be some limited coverage available in some of them. Others might offer a fairly expensive buyback to a degree, but an all-in mold remediation coverage is virtually not available, at least not at a price that we'd be willing to pay. Unit owner policies, however, do most times extend some degree of mold remediation coverage within them and allow some buyback for additional protection that you might deem necessary. But do realize that separation between unit owner and master. You still have mold growing in the walls and damaged drywall, association problem, versus the paint on the wall, carpets, and other items that your unit owner's policy would repair. So not everything's going to be covered, even if it's the unit owner's policy that responds, because they still confine it to what they're responsible for under statute. Question rose earlier, wind-driven rain. Wind-driven rain, is that covered? No. The structure insured must first sustain physical damage from the action of the storm in order for coverage to apply. If because of the force of the wind, water seeps the cracks and crevices of the building, pushes through into the structure and causes damage inside, that is not within the scope of coverage. Not within the scope of coverage. So as I always say, throw a brick through the window and you're home free. Causes of loss. Yes, sir.
If I could, I wanted to address that mold issue. Really.
Yes.
If it's water damage that resulted in mold, there's got to be some type of catastrophic water damage.
Right.
Or roof has fallen off or something like that. You always put forth that it's water damage resulting in mold. If you put forth that it's mold, it won't be covered.
Bingo.
If it's water damage that resulted in mold, your whole loss will be covered.
I do agree with that, and that is a very important point that he's brought up, and in general, how you present the claim and how you lead the company in terms of how they will view it initially. They'll eventually make their own decision, but how you present the claim can govern how the claim is going to be handled. An example, too, would be a question of a water leak versus a pipe break. A leak generally suggests something that has occurred over time, wear, tear, and deterioration. The pipe got old, it leaked. The fitting came loose. A pipe break is a sudden and accidental occurrence not expected nor intended. That is the definition of insurance. So when you've got water damage, don't call in a leak. Call in a water break, a line break in the wall. There's nothing wrong with it. You're not even going to get anyone out to adjust it if you say leak, because that's just not covered. But water damage, the pipe broke in the wall. You don't know. They don't know. Get someone out there to look at how you present the claim can at least get it started in your favor. And you're right with regard to dealing. If you call in a mold claim, you're not covered. Water damage claim with some resultant mold, you will probably gain most of your return, even including some of the mold remediation. Okay, causes of loss. When we're dealing with a disaster like this, there's really only several causes of loss that are going to apply. The big one is wind. Then there's hail. And then there's fire. Short-circuiting, a fire erupts inside one of the units or common areas, and flood. Flood's a standard exclusion. We'll address that separately. But those are the four items that are most likely to occur. And along with that, just general water damage from pipes breaking and things like that that can occur from a damaged building. Those are your usual causes of loss in dealing with the type of problem we have here. The type of policy that is afforded is usually a special form policy. Citizens policy is a basic form policy, and it's important you understand that as well. Not necessarily for the example of our disaster scenario, as much as the earlier point of water damage from a broken pipe. In a basic form policy that Citizens offers, they do not offer coverage for a broken pipe causing water damage. They do take care of the wind, the hail, and the fire, excluding flood. But in order for a Citizens policy holder to broaden their coverage from basic to special, they must buy a wrap, a supplemental, an extra property policy, as we call it, also a DIC, difference in conditions, bunch of different names, your agents will know, that adds in theft, water damage from broken pipes, and a few other perils that are most common to a special form policy that are not covered in the basic. Another thing to watch out for is you deal with the causes of loss that impact damage to your structure. Possible proof issues. Paul, you want to address some of the thoughts along those lines?
Thank you, Lou. A couple of things, just a couple of comments. The gentleman mentioned on supplemental claims a five-year statute of limitations. That would be the general statute of limitations on contracts. Of course, it's not a firm 5 years. It's a 5 years starting from the date you knew, reasonably knew, or should have known about the supplemental claim, with a statute of repose, which means an end date, finally, of 10 years and no more. So you could go beyond 5 years if you can show that you had no reason to know about the supplemental claim, until sometime later. With regard to air conditioners, I've also seen a number of questions have come in about the air conditioning coverage. I don't know why this is causing you folks a lot of heartburn. It's really a very simple issue, and you can analogize it to any other type of improvement in a condo unit. The maintenance responsibility is different from the insurance responsibility. The only time the association comes responsible for the air conditioning system is when the air conditioning system is damaged by a covered loss, a casualty. Then it would be covered by the association's policy. And so it's not a question of changing anyone's contract any more than the Woodside Village case said in 2003 that because condos are creations of statute, the legislature is free to change the rules literally on anything from renting units to who insures what. So because you are creations of statute, you are a laboratory with which the legislature may tinker, and they do tinker every year. So that is how this has come to pass, and that is why your insurance provisions in your condo documents are probably basically out the window, and you do have to distinguish between what is maintenance and what is a covered casualty loss. Okay, sir?
Paul, two questions on AC. The AC coverage for the association begins when we renew our policy after 1 January.
True.
In that situation, the association policy renews, say next October, you're through the first part of the AC season. We have not picked up the AC coverage until October. You have a hurricane in August or September,
yep.
and you have a loss to those AC units. Who is responsible for that? I mean, as an association, do we have to go in and modify our...
Well, no. The answer is going to depend in part on when the owner's policy renewed. So it may be that if the owner's policy renewed, you may have a gap, but also it may be that the owner's policy will cover it. So it really depends on not only your renewal date, but the owner's renewal date as well.
Okay, worst case, owner renewed.
Yeah, worst case is you're going to have a gap, and there'll be no one covering it. And under the Plaza East scenario, that would be an association responsibility.
So under this, and I wasn't Lou on this, as an association, to avoid that gap, we may want to modify our policy on January.
It would not be a bad idea.
It would not be a bad idea. Relative to that,
is if you got an old air AC unit and the air handler is over down below and you have to replace the upper unit, that's not going to be compatible with the lower unit. Now you've got a casualty loss up here, but the system isn't going to work because it's not compatible with what's down below. Who has to replace it?
I would say that's going to be the owner's responsibility. Okay. Well, again, the policy here is to bring the building back to a habitable whole. As long as you have the ducts and wiring and equipment on the roof to be able to adequately air condition that property, it's treated, I think, much the same as a hot water heater, and that would be the owner's responsibility under their policy. Okay. Now, one of the things that we threw at you in this scenario was the south side of the building. The south side of the building had additional damage because of the situation with hurricane shutters. And I think hurricane shutters bears a little discussion. As you know, the statute was again amended to deal with hurricane shutters this year. And I've read it, and I've read it several times, and as near as I can understand it, what the statute now appears to say is, if the governing documents of the association obligate the association to operate the shutters, the association will operate the shutters. And if the documents don't obligate the association to operate the shutters, the unit owners will operate the shutters. That appears to be what the nut and bolt of what it seems to say. And so in our scenario, you have extra damage on the south side of the building, but there are three possible, maybe all simultaneously occurring causes. One, some owners don't have shutters. Okay, we learned from Hurricane Andrew that those people who did not have shutters created an access point for the winds to enter into the building and effectively caused an implosion through those buildings, through those units. So the first question is there negligence on the part of the owner who doesn't have shutters? The answer is we don't know. But I pose the question to you because there is a statutory right to have shutters, but not yet a statutory obligation. But given what we know, you kind of wonder whether or not an owner in the south side of the building might not have a claim against the liability policy of the owner, which is now mandatory to have a liability policy to protect third parties from the insured's negligence. So I would argue that that's a very valid claim for someone to bring. The second conceivable basis for loss here was that the shutters that were dropped failed or did not work. And the documents, you may recall, required the association to operate the shutters. So, is there liability on the part of the association to those owners on the south side who incurred damage as a result of the shutters not working? Answer again, we don't know. Because we don't know whether it was a systemic failure, is a problem with the shutter itself, or with the way it was operated, or perhaps a manufacturing defect. So these are all possible proof problems that will come into play. So you've got a situation where some of the shutters didn't work, some of the shutters weren't there at all, and then, of course, if in a clear case where the association is charged with operating shutters and they're there and they weren't put into place, clearly you've got a claim against the association. Okay, so you have all of these proof problems. I think what you're going to hear, what you're seeing is that when you have a hole, a structure, a building, and everybody owns different pieces of it, and who has to insure what is not unified. You've got 50 owners who are insuring small pieces here and there. You've got one corporate entity that's insuring another portion. You have deductibles that come into play. You have exclusions from coverage. It's a mess. And then you have other bases for claims, such as what I've just discussed with regard to shutters. You could be bringing in third parties like manufacturers. You could be bringing in unit owner insurers. You could be bringing in the unit owners themselves. I mean, this could be a long, protracted process. And these are things that we recognize that the statute doesn't effectively deal with. And frankly, unless you go back to a single monolithic policy with unit owners only insuring literally their own own interior improvements, you're never going to get a clear and easy scenario here. And even if you did that, you'd probably still have some of these residual type of proof problems as to what causes a loss. And so from a legal point of view, you know, the PI attorneys and the product liability attorneys will be drooling and licking their lips for these kinds of things. As an association attorney, I'll lose a little bit more hair. You know, these are some of the limitations on what we have, but it certainly, I have to tell you, is better than what we had under the old statute, because all of these problems existed under the old statute, but now we've at least figured out who does what. One other point, on the Plaza East scenario, where the association's policy basically operates to ensure all of the improvements except those that are specifically excluded under the statute, you can opt in and you can opt out by majority vote of the owners, as Lou was talking about. My question, and I'll ask this to Lou, is will the insurance companies recognize that opt-in or opt-out in their policy?
And yes, they will, as long as it is consistent with statute and as long as the insurance that has been procured is adequate in limits to address the addition of new coverage onto the master policy. Again, as long as the statute has been achieved, they've done the right thing under the statute and voted it and added it properly to the insurance policy, the insurance company will respond. Their initial intent would be to cover it based on the way it exists in the statute right now, until it's proven with a copy of your documents and the amendment that was done that no, we adjusted it, we took the opt, and we applied that to the master policy, all of those items, and we increased our values to accommodate it. Then they'll say, oh, okay, fine, they include it in the claim.
Thank you. He just made my point with regard to what he said when he first stood up, and that is the insurance companies aren't going to want to allow the association to be named insured on the unit owner policies. Hey, if they're going to follow the statute, they're going to follow the statute. They're licensed by the state. They're required to write policies that are consistent with the law of the state. And so if the state statute mandates that you are a named insured, you are a named insured. If they don't do it, then they may be delicensed in the state and perhaps subject to a suit for damages for failing to write the policy that's required by statute. Do you want to address proof issues from an insurance issue?
Regarding the points that Paul has brought up here, these several issues of negligence and responsibility dealing with the association's policy and its liability for not putting down the shutters as they should have, or a unit owner not buying a shutter and causing damage to others, or a product failure. Liability insurance is in place for the product's liability company, we would presume, as well as the installer, we would presume. That's not always the case, but in this situation, we'll assume it's there. As well, the association's liability is in place to protect them for their negligence, as is the unit owner's liability policy. Now, what happens in these scenarios? We have reason to believe, as we assess the matter of proof of loss and question of responsibility, the insurance company that is going to come in and adjust the master policy and the unit owner's policy, they're going to do so always with a reservation of rights, because they're going to look at what has happened and determine if there might not be third-party responsibility for the degree of damage involved. The next step, after they may pay your claim, is to subrogate back against the third party they feel might be negligent in the matter. So your master policy, in all likelihood, is going to respond to pay your claim. If they feel that because a unit owner did not buy the policy, not buy the shutter,
and it resulted in more damage than should have occurred on that south side, they have the right without obligation then to subrogate back against that unit owner and his unit owner's liability policy to get their money back. As well, if the product failed, they can pay the claim and subrogate back against the product manufacturer or installer for additional damage that might not have occurred had the product worked properly or been installed properly. Furthering that is the association's potential failure to have come in and done their due duty in dropping the shutters to begin with. Their failure resulted in more damage than should have had to have occurred had the shutters been properly dropped. That could be deemed an association negligence. And then there's a liability claim from the unit owner's policies for additional damage that might not have occurred on the inside of that unit had the association done their job. And then there's another matter of adequate insurance. Procuring the right amounts and kinds of insurance, you fail to do so. You don't get everything covered. You miss a building. You don't have enough insurance or the right kind. You didn't cover the wind. You bought fire only. So those that are impacted by the failures of the board's decision decide to sue the board under directors and officers' liability. Is it covered? Interesting. Failure to procure proper amounts or kinds of insurance is typically not intended to be covered under a director's and officer's liability policy. That much said, the five or six companies that are out there providing the broader form D&O contract will typically include some coverage for failure to procure proper amounts or kinds of insurance, but it is always limited to defense only. If you lose, the judgment's your baby. But they'll defend you. And that's about as far as it goes. So the importance of knowing what you're buying, making good, reasonable decisions on the coverages applicable, and making sure you avoid some of the pitfalls is certainly crucial. Because if you fail to buy the right stuff, regardless of matters of negligence, then you got a D&O problem that may or may not be covered.
Let me just ask this because it's come up in some of the questions that have been handed up here. With regard to the association of checking and making sure that the individual owners have policies, while it says may, if the association doesn't pursue this, okay, and now there's a disaster and you don't have insurance money from the owner, which is integral to reconstructing the property, that also would be a D&O claim against the association, correct? And that also would give you only a defense but no payment of a claim. Therefore, I again urge you, while the statute may say may, you need to go ahead and make sure that your owners have their individual policies. I have one question here where people on the board are adamant about not having their own insurance. Frankly, I would try to recall those board members or at least not have them elected because they are setting an example. They are creating a breach of fiduciary duty in their own situation as directors by not setting a proper example and carrying forward with what is necessary. Clearly, this statute contemplates a partnership between the owners and the association in terms of the ability to reconstruct the property.
Thank you, Paul. Moving on, the role of the unit owner policies. Now, we've hit on a lot of these interactions already, but a couple of important points to drive home regarding things we've already talked about and some new issues. Going back to that question of loss assessment versus special assessment, Are they the same thing? We believe so, but in fact the insurance contract is worded loss assessment, the statute is special assessment. Maybe a minor detail, maybe not. Depends on how bad the insurance company wants to fight the question of what their insurance does or doesn't do. And then we talked earlier about the question of the deductible being covered or not by the matter of loss assessment. Some will, some won't. And then there's this new requirement that you must have at least $2,000 of special assessment coverage. Now we get into a similar point that we have with the additional named insured. Paul is correct. The insurance companies have an obligation, if they're licensed here, to follow the statutory requirements. On the other hand, they could say no and leave the state. How likely is that? Who knows? But they've got that right as well. They will run their business as they see fit. And many will be very, very resistant to the matter of additional named insured. On the question of the $2,000 special assessment coverage, aka loss assessment, will they give you that if they have a current rule of no more than $1,000, as some do? We have several individual unit owner companies out there who cap their loss assessment benefit to a unit owner policy to $1,000. That's it. Now, given the option of going somewhere else, possibly at a higher premium, does that company have the right to maintain their rule of $1,000? Statute says you got to provide. The statute says you've got to buy $2,000. That doesn't necessarily mean the company has to give it to you, the one that you're with.
Question.
Yes.
In obtaining the information as to whether you have the coverage or not, isn't there a lot of detail that needs to be verified for coverage?
With regard to the agent and the unit owner working together to determine the need.
With respect to the board, I guess.
Certainly, and that also becomes an education process. What the gentleman is asking is, does this responsibility of getting the unit owner's coverage and having each year a copy on file pose additional responsibilities to the board to make sure it is in fact adequate and proper? I believe it does add more to your responsibility, particularly where what you receive happens to be a fire policy only with no wind and no liability. They issue them. They're out there. They're cheap. But does that follow the spirit of the statute? We'd certainly think not in terms of the definition of adequate insurance. And if you get one and just look at it and say, okay, this guy, unit 201, yep, he's got it, he's got it. If that's all you're doing, you may be incurring some additional problems and liabilities in terms of enforcing the matter of coverage for the unit owner and whether or not it was the right coverage for the situation. Paul, do you have a thought on that? Feel any?
No, I absolutely agree with what you said.
Very good. Okay. Yeah, yes, sir.
Is there any such thing as a form that could be sent out to the individual owners certifying that they do have the necessary coverage to be sent back to the board to make them? So the board would have proof of that coverage as opposed to the board having to review every single insurance policy?
I'm afraid that, a certificate of insurance, as Paul is saying, certainly would be adequate proof if it is presented by the insurance agent through the manager or direct to the board, as the case may be. Managers are getting more responsibility in this too, you betcha, to confirm coverage. But simply a written affidavit that is intended to be a legal document where the unit owner sends you a letter that has been notarized and looks legal, that says, I've got this, this, and this, and it expires here. Is that enough? No, that's not what they're looking for. We want a certificate or a copy of the deck page of the policy that confirms the type of coverage that exists on that unit owner's policy. Yes, yes, sir?
I guess the question is what authority does the board then have? Is there something in the statute that says that unit owners have to have exactly this type of insurance to be called adequate? And then secondly, what authority does the board have to then go back to the unit owner and say what you have is not adequate, and if he refuses to do it, what do you do then?
Okay. No, the statute is not specific on the matter of exactly what coverages that unit owner must carry. I think we fall back then to the matter of discussion, adequate insurance, which I believe to be, arguably, fire, wind, and liability. A fire policy includes all the other stuff, typically vandalism and smoke and theft and whatnot, typically. Maybe not theft, but certainly most of the other things. But if you've got a fire, wind, and liability coverage applicable, you're pretty well home free for the things that you should be worried about. The statute hasn't specified it. Yet, the board now has a responsibility to oversee this matter, and if they find an inadequacy, it would strike me then they have a responsibility of making the unit owner aware and effectively requiring them to upgrade their policy to proper amounts and kinds. Failing to do so, I believe we revert back to the new statutory requirement of you got to get it for them if they fail to do it. Because they are wanting that unit owner to stand properly on his own two feet and have adequate insurance to pay for the damages that certainly could be incurred as a result of a windstorm policy, of a windstorm. And if he doesn't carry a windstorm policy, that's a material gap and breach of the intent. And you certainly would expect that then the board would act to make sure they get that. But it's not stated specifically. But that's the flow of the argument as I see it.
I know our unit owner. I know some of them are going to argue that.
Of course they will.
And they will then argue the fact that we are not legally able to to get that insurance for them, and therefore.
Okay, it may not, but what the statute says is that the association shall require each owner, so that's mandatory, to provide evidence of currently effective policy of hazard and liability insurance. Now, there are certain things in here that the association's policy is supposed to cover. The rest of it, the exclusions, are to be covered by the owner's policy. There is also a requirement that there be $2,000 in special assessment coverage. Okay, if the policy doesn't show that, then it's not adequate. I don't care whether an owner chooses to insure or what value they choose to insure their possessions about. All I care is whether or not the amount of liability coverage, which is, I think, Lou, typically some dollar figure based on $300,000, that's going to be adequate. That's liability. But the property, the casualty insurance, ought to be tied to that percentage of the owner's ownership of the common elements times the assessed value. Okay?
How do you enforce it?
You enforce it if they don't provide it for you. You purchase a policy, and the cost of that is an assessment, which can then be subject to a notice of intent to lien, a notice of intent to foreclose, and a foreclosure. That is the foreclosure. That is the enforcement mechanism. There's no other procedure for doing that. What I said was this, and we talked about it earlier. This statute requires a periodic appraisal of the fair market value of your property every 3 years. All I'm suggesting to you is if you're looking for a number, you take that figure, you multiply it by that owner's percentage ownership of the condominium, and that would be a reasonably acceptable figure for the casualty amount of the policy. Okay?
Thank you.
Sure.
And I might add, as you deal with the question of what's supposed to be a part of that unit owner's policy, 718.111 begins, every hazard policy issued, hazard policy. And then it goes on within the full statute to explain that hazard concept. So when we now adopt the unit owner requirement as hazard insurance, we are effectively tying in the unit owner need to essentially the same concept that governs the master. Hazard is hazard, either side of it. And that means all that stuff. Wind and fire and whatnot. Okay? Now,
the board still can't be paid. You just have to do all this stuff.
Yeah, they still can't be paid. You still got to do all this stuff. Okay, a couple more questions. We don't want to get bogged down too much. Yes, sir. Yes, please.
As a result of the foreclosure process, I found the necessary to turn power on in a number of units, and the association is now paying for those because they basically abandoned the units. Now, does that mean I now have to, because I'm sure they don't have insurance either, I'm now stuck having to pay for insurance for those apartments also?
No, you're not unless you're the property owner. Again, I don't know what the status of the unit is. If it's in foreclosure, I think I'm fine. You can buy a policy on it, and then once there is a new owner, you can cancel that policy, and you can pursue the new owner to provide insurance.
Practicalities are that it's now taking a period of 1 year to buy a foreclosure story until it's done.
Yep.
That 1 year period involved.
Yep.
And that owner is basically abandoned.
Yep.
Not paying for anything anymore.
Mm-hmm.
What happens? Do I have to pick up the insurance?
Well, as of October 1st, the answer would be appropriate, yes.
Okay.
Let me say this to you folks. I mean, this is not a unique issue. We're getting a little far afield here. Your homeowners associations are facing the same problem. Everybody's got foreclosures. And what is needed here is a legislative solution. I have given a draft of legislation to Senator Lynn in the Daytona area, and I understand she's put it into bill drafting that would allow associations, when they do certain specified types of repairs or actions to preserve property, to get an administrative priority claim against the proceeds in the foreclosure. Now, whether or not the mortgage lobby will fight that, I don't know. There's also another move afoot to increase the percentage that foreclosing lenders have to pay to associations when they acquire title. Traditionally, the banker's lobby comes in and squashes any attempt to dial up that digit from 1% to 5% or anything like that. Whether they'll do it again this year, we don't know. I mean, the financial market is in such turmoil, this is certainly not a unique situation, but frankly, what is needed is a legislative solution to the question you've asked. And we're going to try to keep going on this subject.
Okay, let's move on. We'll probably answer some of these questions as we evolve into the rest of this in the second scenario. Furthering the role of unit owner policies, we deal with the matter of interior damage. And of course, as we deal with interior damage, we deal with that question of who's responsible for what and how much of it do you take and insure on your unit owner's policy. It's fairly clearly defined now in the statute what the unit owner is responsible to insure. If it isn't one of the listed items, then the unit owner doesn't insure it. They might be required to maintain it, but they don't insure it. And anything else
is the master policy. And essentially what we're dealing with is drywall stage. That's master policy. Drywall stage without cabinets. You walk in and everything's looking pretty barren. And as soon as you add paint and carpet and tile and cabinets, then it's looking like a home. That's the portion the unit owner is responsible to deal with. Arguably, $30, $40 a square and up, depending on the quality of your upgrades. And dealing with the question here, what do we do about the matter of upgrades? And dealing with matters of upgraded cabinets. Well, we're dealing in the master policy with matters of original plans and specifications or replacements thereof of like kind and quality. So the master policy is only going to respond based on what was there when the unit was originally conveyed. Anything else you do to that unit, any upgrades to that, are your responsibility over and above what the master policy would pay. Might include an enclosed lanai or something like that. As you deal with the matter of cabinets, which are the responsibility of the unit owner already, that is something that's going to be insured based on what it's worth. What'd you put in there? Upgrades on carpet, same thing. But since the shower stalls and toilets are master policy, yes, there are some toilets that can cost a couple of $1,000. You can also get them for $250. If all you had at construction grade was a $250 commode and you purchased a $2,000 upgrade, the difference is on your policy and it should be so recorded and managed under your unit owner's policy. Additionally, all your stuff. Make sure you have adequate coverage for your contents and that they're properly separated. You don't add them together on your policy. Your agent knows this. You have one amount for contents, another for your inside responsibilities, now exclusive of the air conditioning, and that includes the ducts and the air handler and the external unit. The whole shoot and match now falls back to the master policy and no longer the responsibility to insure by the unit owner. Maintain, in all likelihood. Insure, no. Absence of liability coverage for owners who didn't have shutters. We've discussed that, and now you have a problem. The unit owner did not have shutters, and he did not have liability, and he's being sued for negligence. That's out of your own pocketbook, folks. And if a judgment is procured, they can address your savings and other things that are attachable. They can't take your residence, but they can sure take the profit from a future sale, as I understand it. So they can make life pretty miserable for you if you don't have adequate coverage for negligence that you cause once it's proven and the judge says you pay. Absence of liability coverage for owners whose shutters didn't work. Now we have a different scenario. The unit owner may get sued in that example in a shotgun approach, but in all likelihood, if they didn't work, it's probably not his or her negligence. But they're still going to have to come out of pocket to defend the allegation that drew them into the suit in the first place. Once again, making sure you have some basic personal liability avoids you spending extra money out of your reserves and checking account, your personal reserves and checking account, to take care of a defense on an allegation. And all anyone has to do this day and age is allege that they think you did something wrong, and you're going to get one of our trial attorneys willing to take the case. And off you go. Personal liability, very important. handling of unit improvements, I think we probably addressed that fairly well in terms of the difference between original plan specs as originally conveyed, upgrades in that regard, improvements in closing that lanai. Things that are exclusive to your use are likely going to end up being your responsibility, even though, as we talked about earlier, the opt could be to bring those into the master policy.
We had some questions on that as well. Please understand, it's what the association insures is the originally specced and the originally constructed property. So if someone builds a takes a screened enclosure and frames it in and turns it into a room, those improvements will be the owner's responsibility to insure and to restore with the association's supervision. Similarly, the statute also permits that if there are certain structures or improvements, for example, a boat dock that is used by less than all owners, the association can pass on the cost of insuring those structures to the owners who have the use and benefit of it to the exclusion of the rest of the members of the association. Now, I know Gary Polyakov in particular is very concerned about this language because of the use of the word improvement, and his concern is that everyone is going to start being told that their own policies covers the entire building in which they live. And I don't believe that's a really significant concern. I believe the intent here is clear because of the other language in the statute. But there is this ability to, A, make the owner responsible for their own improvements that they have made to the property, and B, if they have some sort of either a limited common element or perhaps a lease from the association of a boat slip, they become responsible for the cost of insuring that improvement that they have the use of. Okay. Should we move to our second scenario, or should we take some questions? Because we're running out of time. It's just 11:05.
And we're going until
11:30.
Okay. Yeah, we might want to go on.
Okay. We're going to just take the second scenario for you, and then we'll answer the rest of these questions. I've got some good ones. I love some of the questions, especially the ones that have nothing to do with this subject. And whoever asked me the question about staggered terms, come up and I'll give you my 5-minute scenario of staggered terms. Here's our second scenario. Cocoa Beach takes a direct hit from the east from Hurricane Annette, a Category 4 hurricane. It strikes a two-story multi-condominium project named Patty's Hideaway Condominium. This community has 10 two-story buildings, and each building has 10 units. It's a multi-condo because each building has its own recorded declaration. All of these condominiums are operated by a single association, a classic multi-condo association. Patty's Hideaway Condominium was built in the mid-1970s. It has concrete block construction with wood truss roofs. It has not been hardened or structurally updated since its original construction. The 5 buildings closest to the shore are completely destroyed. The second 5 buildings are without roofs, and although currently uninhabitable, they are repairable. However, it's unclear, given the current, quote, country estate zoning classification of the property, whether the 5 destroyed buildings can be rebuilt in their current configuration as a matter of zoning law. The property casualty coverage on each building includes a windstorm policy with a 3% deductible. Each building will cost $950,000 to replace, but each is insured for only $700,000. The association carries a flood insurance policy and accepted the law and ordinance coverage option on the master policy. 2 of the 5 destroyed buildings are found to have collapsed due to the force of the storm surge. The other 3 destroyed buildings were destroyed primarily by the force of the wind. Okay? The association took no actions to prepare for a disaster. None of the condominiums have reserves, and the association has only about $15,000 cash on hand. How many of you live in this community? Okay. Okay. I'm going to ask Lou to briefly discuss the co-insurance issues and the adequate coverage issues and the law and order coverage issue, because that's important also.
Thank you, Paul. Now, that one's got all sorts of complex issues. First, co-insurance. Let's assume for a moment that we have a $950,000 building. We have a policy that insures that building for $700,000, and we have a 100% co-insurance clause on the policy, which basically means that the amount of insurance must at least equal 100% of the value of the property, which also means it should have been insured at $950,000, not $700,000. What co-insurance then means is your claim payment will be limited to the ratio of what you insured for against what you should have insured for. Making the math a little bit easier, you have a $1 million building insured for $700,000. You're 30% underinsured. Your claim will be docked 30%. So, if they're going to have partial damage in the second row of buildings, and you have a $300,000 claim, they're going to dock $90,000 off of that payment on the partial claim, and instead of getting $300,000, you're going to get $210,000. That is a co-insurance penalty. And that's why it's so important to make sure the amount of coverage is at least consistent with the co-insurance amount that you and your agent choose. You have three options, 80, 90, or 100% co-insurance. If these people had had an 80% co-insurance contract, they could have gotten away with insuring the buildings at a little under $800,000. They would have still been short, but not by nearly as much. So the amount of co-insurance percentage that you decide to take will impact how your claim is paid. And you get a reduced rate by agreeing to carry more coverage. That's why the 100% might be appealing. The base is 80%. You can get 100%. If you agree to carry 20% more insurance, 100% instead of 80%, 20% more, they give you a 10% discount on the premium. That's appealing, particularly in this time of high prices. But it obviously comes with this penalty impact. You better be right going in, because if you're not, you're going to get penalized. Watch your co-insurance, understand the reasons for it, play the game consistent with your appraisal, and push the problem off to the professional liability of the appraiser, and make sure you get it done right. Adequate coverage then falls in the scope of that question of the appraised value and how much insurance you must carry to replace the property. If you have inadequate coverage, don't come look into the D&O to bail you out. It'll offend you. It won't pay your problem. So as you deal with this question of adequacy, were these people adequately covered? Absolutely not. Not even close. They've got 100% requirement. They're insured to 70% of the need. They're going to get a problem. Notwithstanding, Florida's valued policy law says if the property's destroyed, they pay you the face amount of the policy. So those buildings that went down, you're still going to get the $700,000. But you're still co-insurer for the other $250,000. You need $950,000. You're only going to get $700,000. So the company figures you're already in bad enough shape by having inadequate insurance, so they don't dock that by another percentage. So if it goes down entirely, you get what you paid for. If it's a partial loss, as in my earlier example, where there was only $300,000 of damage, that's where they dock you additionally for the inadequate coverage against your coinsurance requirement. Make sure your replacement cost is consistent with your needs. And I have seen appraisals on the same property, $80 a square and $35 a square. Same parcel, different appraisals, appraisers. It's incredible. And if that guy only has $1 million of coverage and he's got all these erroneous appraisals out there, how far is that going to go? Yes, sir.
Registration says appraisal can take 6 months.
Correct.
Looking at our appraised replacement cost between 2000 and 2008, it has increased almost by 100%. So how realistic is a 36-month appraisal?
It depends on how far off the original one that went up so much was.
They were sort of, there were others between them.
Yeah.
One
thing the legislators were trying to do is avoid you having to spend money to update this stuff every 6 months. You can get it more frequently and try to nail it a little more accurately within the scope of what's prudent and what you've seen. You just have to get it every 36. You can do it every 6 if you want to. That's up to you. So those are minimum requirements, not the mandatory only 36-month.
To answer one question we received, yes, in my opinion, the appraiser must be licensed in Florida in order to give you that appraisal.
That is correct. That is correct. Citizens won't accept an appraisal unless it's by a licensed appraiser. And us agents aren't that. So those that are looking to your agent to give you that answer, we give you a ballpark, but it has to be backed up by the real thing. Yes, sir.
No.
An inspection is different from a value appraisal. Okay. Okay. Law and ordinance. We'll get around. Law and ordinance. That is dealing with code changes. In the case of this community, the question of law and ordinance may be less of a factor because they're so off base in the amount of coverage that they have. But let's assume for a moment that this community that was built in the 70s now has code guidelines that make the value to replace that building much higher. $950,000 is what sits there today. That's like kind and quality of materials and workmanship. But that doesn't include the requirement for sprinklering and other new guidelines, different type of roof, that might run up the cost of that construction from $950,000 to $1,100,000. Another $150,000 of construction cost is involved in this scenario due to code changes. Law and ordinance is what gives this older property that additional $150,000 to apply toward the new code requirements. The older you are, the more important it is. The newer you are, like in the first scenario where they opted out of it, is because they feel, and are probably accurate, there hasn't been much change since 2002 to impact them enough to concern themselves over this additional protection. Always a good idea if you can get it, and Citizens doesn't offer it. But nonetheless, the older the community, the more desirable and maybe even necessary that added protection would be. Law and ordinance, it is called. Increased cost of construction due to code. Impact on D&O for failure to have proper insurance, we've discussed. Multi-condo issues.
Yeah, I wanted to raise two issues here to discuss briefly. One of the things that the 718-111-11 allows to happen is if you have a multi-condo, as we've described here, in other words, you have each building is a separate condominium because there's a separate declaration of condominium for each one, and they're operated by a single association. Upon a vote of a majority of all of the voting interests, you can treat that condo as a single condo for insurance purposes. I recommend you take that vote to do that. Otherwise, you've got problems because each separate condominium, each separate building will have to deal with the reconstruction process separately. The owners in that building will have to pay for that reconstruction process. They may have their own issues with regard to coverage or value. I think it's much better to put the power, consolidate the power of the entire community, take that vote and do that. That's point number one. Point number two, in this community, the facts we gave you said that some of the units that were destroyed might not be able to be rebuilt as a matter of law because the zoning had changed and now required larger properties to be put, larger lots rather than multifamily. In this situation, you are now faced squarely with a question of termination of the condominium. That is governed by Section 718.117, which has been rewritten last year and then modified slightly this year. It was originally vetoed by Jeb Bush because it did kind of overreach. But the fact of the matter is, when it becomes legally impossible to rebuild the property, that is a basis for termination. Or when the total cost to repair, and this might be applicable in this scenario, when the cost of repair is greater than the fair market value of what would then be there, that is another basis for termination. And what happens in that situation is you have to take a vote to terminate. And the vote to terminate is the lesser of the percentage necessary to amend the documents or the percentage that's stated in the documents to terminate the condo. Whichever is the lesser number is the number you would have. I'm not going to go in great detail through the termination process, but there is a scenario for creation of a termination plan, converting the condominium into ownership as tenants in common, apportionment of the cost. There's an expedited judicial procedure for people who don't appreciate the valuation of their unit, and ultimately the property is then sold because it is the policy of the state to not encourage the reconstruction of condominiums when to do so would constitute economic waste. So in this scenario, I think what we really are talking about is the likely possibility that at least part of this condominium would be terminated. Okay? Now, we have a number of questions. You want to talk? Okay, one more from Lou, and then I want to get some questions in here.
And this, because the question came up earlier, and it is one of my note issues, and that is relative to the two buildings that collapsed because of flooding. And that is, of course, the reason why the guy on the top floor needs it as bad as the guy on the bottom floor. The largest claims paid are the demise of the structure as a result of the wave action, resulting in a collapse of structure. And here we have a total loss as a result of flood and not wind. The other three were a combination, and we're assuming in this example that they carried flood, in which case a trained adjuster is going to see the dividing line of where the flood ended and the wind began, below which the flood policy pays, above which the wind policy pays. They've got it down to fairly good science, and that's how it coordinates. The question now is the matter of, has much changed in the flood requirement? The new statute says, adequate hazard insurance shall be based upon the replacement cost of the property to be insured. That's the definition of adequate hazard insurance. Now, in my opinion, that hasn't changed from what happened in the prior statute. You had the same thing. But now they're giving you, as we discussed earlier, some options relative to coinsurance and deductibles to modify some of those considerations. so that you can take that $1 million building, that's the full replacement cost, take an 80% co-insurance clause and insure it for $800,000. You follow that logic, you're allowed now legally to do it. It's what we've been doing all along. But now basically they validated the co-insurance rights and options and the deductible options that most of us have exercised along the way anyway. Now we really have the right to do it. With regard to a flood policy, you are capped at $250,000 a unit under the National Flood Program. That's it. Is that enough? Does it meet the spirit of the statute? Well, if you need $350,000 a unit to replace, technically it does not. And with knowledge that there are excess flood policies available over and above what National Flood makes available, are you then obligated to acquire that excess flood policy? Within the pure interpretation of the statute, I would venture to say the answer to that is yes. On the other hand, with certain considerations of voting options, I would go on to suggest that if you took the opt of having the flood limited to the national flood maximum, and that was your opt relative to amounts and deductibles, you're legal to the policy, you're legal to the statute. And that would be the direction you would need to go if you wished to avoid having to buy an excess flood. Yes? Sure.
We'll go into different cities where they get flooded. Every single time the insurance companies will try to exclude it if they do not have floods. So if there's a question of whether it's caused by windstorm or flood, they're going to say flood every time, especially if you have no insurance for that.
Right.
And flood does not only just cover hurricanes, it covers anything that comes from the outside in. Mm-hmm. So say you have some type of a flood from a street that overflows, or you have some type of a sewage loss outside from a backflow, it's also in your flood policy. So that's standard damage that happens not during the major losses from the hurricane. Mm-hmm. So I mean, you've got to address those too. And I recommend everyone to always get the flood. It's a minimal cost compared to your other insurance, and it just covers so much. And it makes it so you don't have that exclusion, so you don't come in there and have massive damage to your property and not be covered. When we did Katrina, there was about 1 out of 100 homes that was covered, and about 1 out of every 50 businesses that we go to had actual flood insurance. So that's a major thing where you lose millions and millions of dollars if you don't have it. And as far as interpretation of damage, the adjusters will actually take pictures, and it goes through the debris line on the for flood damage, and everything above the debris line is considered windstorm, with the exception of structural damage that would be caused by the flood. It could be attributed to the structural damage or the income of the water. That would also be attributed to flood. So you'll have structural damage plus debris line. And those will be photographs that you need to take if you ever actually have a flood. You'll take pictures of the debris line and then assess the structural damage.
Very good. Thank you. Now, we're going to, we got limited time remaining. We'll open up for questions.
Let me address some of the ones we've got here. And this is a particularly good one. Two questions. What responsibility does the association have to inspect units after a storm? Very good question. The statute on emergency powers says that these powers, including the ability to go in and mitigate damages, may but are not required to be exercised by the board. So you're not required to go in and do emergency inspections. However, I remind you that 718.111 sub 5 says that the association has an irrevocable right of access to each unit during reasonable hours when necessary for the maintenance, repair, or replacement of any common elements or any portion of the unit to be maintained by the association, or when necessary to prevent damage to the common elements or to units. So while you may not have to do this on an emergency basis, you will have to do it. I respectfully suggest that if you have the ability to exercise the emergency powers, you do so, because by getting out all the damp rugs and drywall and all that, you're going to save a whole lot of money in terms of taking out the mold and mildew and drying out the place. The second good question is, if an association adopts a pre-authorized special assessment to cover insured losses, does this have to be listed on the estoppel letter when the unit is sold? My recommendation would be absolutely yes. You have to give notice to the owner, a prospective buyer, of those obligations, and that would be a contingent obligation. Very good question. I think the answer is yes. With regard to if an owner is an owner negligent for not having hurricane shutters, the same as one who has shutters that do not meet the wind zone requirements for his condo area. And I add this to it. Can the association require mandate the installation of shutters for each owner? I suggest on the first question, if that owner doesn't have shutters that comply with the wind load requirements, who's at fault here? It's the board who adopts the shutter specification. If he put in shutters that didn't comply with your specification, he's at fault. But if he adopted shutters, if he used your specifications and they weren't good specifications, you're at fault. What I suggest you do here, I think, is obvious. Amend your documents. Mandate the question of shutters and then allow the association to operate them. I think that combination is the most effective way to protect your property. That's a good question. You don't have to retrofit, but you ought to think about it. Okay? Thank you, Harry. Let's see. The association could be responsible for purchasing a policy for a unit during foreclosure, for powering the unit to prevent mold from accumulating, and for loss of monthly assessments. What is my opinion on budgeting bad debt to cover these items? I absolutely believe in having a bad debt line item. Frankly, it's an appropriate way to more equitably apportion the expenses by overstating them, so that you eliminate the bad debt and then have the actual operating cost remaining to be divided among the units who are actually going to pay it. So I absolutely believe you should have a bad debt line in the budget. This is a good one, too. If the board does not utilize experts, what is its exposure? If this creates a breach of fiduciary duty, are the board members at risk personally? It would definitely be a breach of fiduciary duty for a board member to dabble in an area in which he or she has no expertise without consulting an expert. Using good advice and the utmost care are the essence of a fiduciary duty. If you don't have that information, just winging it is a breach of fiduciary duty. Do you have personal liability? Probably not, except insofar as you are a unit owner and would be responsible for your pro rata share of any judgment that was entered against the association which wasn't covered by insurance. And as Lou has said several times, if there's a situation where it's lack of insurance, chances are if you get bagged for that, you will wind up being the association having to pay that claim, and you will pay your pro rata to share for your own mistake. Let's see. If the association does not adopt a pre-authorized special assessment, do they still have to get copies of the owner's insurance? The answer is yes. Okay, it is two separate issues. You don't have to do the special assessment, though we recommend it. And yes, you shall require that each owner have insurance and provide you proof of that at least once a year. Two separate issues. We have limited common elements at each unit, which started out as screened porches. Some have been enclosed to make rooms out of them. Whose responsibility is to insure? I've explained this one already. The association would insure and rebuild back to the original screen configuration. Any improvements made by the owner are their responsibility to insure. Okay. Who pays for mold inspections due to wind? What's that say?
Rain
when water
affects drywall.
You want to answer that?
If the item that's been damaged is association responsibility, the association would pay. However, in the real world, the first person that notices it needs to get in touch with someone to have it looked at and worry about who gets reimbursed later once the determination of what was damaged is figured out. Because the longer you wait, the worse the problem gets. So the initial likelihood is the unit owner is going to recognize he's got a mold problem. Get someone out there and check it out, probably through the association's property manager or some other individual. Worry about who's going to pay for it later. Get someone out there. But in all likelihood, there'll be some sharing of costs somewhere along the line. So it's less the question of who pays, because it's probably going to end up being shared, as opposed to reaction time and getting it done.
This last one on this issue, this person I think has it wrong. It says the association is responsible to rebuild owner interior to original configuration. That is not a correct statement. Your responsibility is to put it, the shell of the unit back, in other words, the exterior perimeter drywall. That is your responsibility. Wall, floor, and ceiling coverings, interior partition walls that are not load-bearing would be the owner's responsibility under their policy. Therefore, this language about stress-related heart failure really is not applicable. So, do you have anything else? Okay. Finally, if the law states that unit owners must have insurance and they don't comply, can the association bring legal action against them for breaking the law? Well, this isn't criminal. You're not going to have them arrested. Your remedy is provided in the statute is to purchase the policy, lien, and foreclose on their unit, and that is one of the most coercive remedies that the law allows, to literally divest somebody of ownership and boot them out of their own home. That is your remedy. Sir?
Yes, I just have one other question.
Yes, ma'am. No, as a condo attorney, I, in order to be admitted, I had to agree never to live in one.
That is, the question was, the gentleman's agent has suggested that 90% coinsurance is the same as full coverage. Now, there's two lines of thought there. In the pure concept, if you've got $1 million building and it's only insured for $900,000, that's obviously not full coverage. Right? So if that's the principle that he's working on, the answer is that he is in error on that point. On the other hand, my most common approach to managing a policy is to insure at 100% with a 90% coinsurance requirement. That way I've got a 10% leeway for inflation. So I insure at 100% of value with a 90% requirement. So if I get some inflation during the year going up towards 100%, I'm still in compliance with the coinsurance guideline. So the pure principle of taking $1 million building and insuring it at $900,000 under 90% guidelines is not full coverage. But if you insure at 100% of value with a 90% requirement, I say, or even 80, that's good because you're building in that inflation room in case of changes during the policy term. Depends on which side of that angle he might be on. Yes.
About the shutters, can the association require an installation of shutters?
Yeah. As I said, amend your documents to require it. Amend your documents to require it.
As it's set now, no, they do.
They are not required.
Not required.
I have three questions, and I would ask the people who gave me the questions about the office administrator in the mail, the staggered terms, and the hotel condos to come up here, and I'll address your questions very quickly. I think that's it. Harry, thank you very much, folks, for staying with us.
What a program. Paul, Lou, thank you. Great, great job. There will be a board meeting as soon as this meeting breaks up.